Welcome to Talking About Singing, where we talk about singing. This week, we're very excited to welcome our guest, Craig Bauer. You might know him from his Grammy-nominated work on Kanye West's first three albums, Lupe Fiasco's debut album. You might have seen Ed Sheeran perform in Hinge Studios, which he owns and operates. Or, my personal favorite, you might know him from mixing SNL's Mother Lover sketch with Justin Timberlake and Andy Samberg. Craig, how are you doing today?
I'm great. And if you like all that, wait till you hear me sing.
All right. The next 6 minutes is going to be completely a cappella.
Yeah, maybe not. Let's stick to the engineering.
Sounds good. Are all those facts correct? Did the internet lie to me anywhere?
Amazingly enough, all those facts are correct. Yeah, it's all true. Go figure.
You opened Hinge Studios in 1993. Is that right?
That sounds about right. It feels like two lifetimes ago, but yes, that is true.
That is exactly where I want to start. As someone who very much likes a 9-to-5 job, how did you get into just opening up a studio? Was that completely on your own?
How did I get into it? You know, there's not a simple answer to that question, so I'll try to keep it, you know, reasonably brief. It starts long before 93, oddly enough. I grew up studying piano my whole life. I had a next-door neighbor that fancied himself as a singer. This is, you know, going literally back to elementary school. And somewhere in junior high school, we got asked to go for a community charity thing, go into a recording studio, which was basically a voiceover studio in downtown Chicago, Cleveland at the time, and record a cover song, which we did. And I remember walking into this very small little overdub booth that had 287s in it, and I dragged a Fender Rhodes down there. And I remember putting on headphones, having never done anything in recording at that point, obviously as a, you know, teenager. Stuck out headphones, played a few notes, and we began to sing. And I remember hearing reverb. Of course, I didn't know the term reverb at the time. Heard some reverb and some delay in the headphones and was just so unbelievably blown away with that experience that literally from that moment on, it was a, you know, direct ascent and one-way path to, you know, what I'm currently doing. That's where it started, amazingly enough.
Wow.
Wow. What do you say to that? I don't even know. So when I was a senior in high school, as a graduation present, I actually got a small loan from my father. That was my graduation present. And with that, I bought a little four-track reel-to-reel machine and a six-channel Tascam mixer. And such began my endeavor into the recording business as a senior in high school. And that's literally where it all started.
Just on a four-track?
On a four-track reel-to-reel machine. Of course, this is, you know, showing my age a little bit. But yes, somewhere on my Instagram page, there's probably a picture of me in a bedroom with this four-track and a six-channel mixer. And from that moment on, it's just been, you know, 24/7 of this is what I want to do. And I've never looked back to the expense of, you know, higher education. Although I do have a degree in music from Ohio State University, I didn't take education very seriously from that first experience in a recording studio.
Yeah. You studied classical piano and music education. Have you always kind of had an ear for hip hop, or is that just where kind of the talent coming into the studio turned out to be?
My very first experience with hip hop was this group called the Go-Getters that came into my studio in Chicago and had to be 93, 94, first year or two of opening my studio. And of course, for those who don't already know, the founding and main member of that group was this kid named Kanye West, who no one had ever heard of before, obviously. And it was also his first experience in a recording studio as well. So go figure, that was my very first endeavor into hip hop as a nice white kid from the suburbs of Cleveland.
Wow, that you realize how completely just unfair that is to the thousands of other just hip hop heads out there.
It was so new to me. And of course, that group, which I think the story has been fairly well documented in a few places. Complex Media did a story on it. I don't know, not that long ago, within the past year, that can easily be found as well. You know, these guys came in and frankly didn't really know what the hell they were doing any more than I did at the time. It went on for a year. We worked together, you know, many, many times over a course of a few years. That whole story began with his managers at the time, of which one of them is still with him, walked into my office in this new studio that I opened in the first year or so and kind of begged me to cut them a break. I think I was charging $75 an hour at the time, and I don't remember what break I ended up giving them. But that's where it all started. The Go-Getters didn't last very long, and somehow Kanye, you know, broke through all that. And somewhere down the line, a year or two, I was spending many nights a week recording him doing beats, which were being ghostwritten for Diddy. And that went on for quite some time. And all during that, he was, you know, also working on his solo, you know, experience as an artist. And all of those sessions ultimately led up to what became College Dropout.
So during that time specifically, were you helping him with the production or beats or anything? Or was you just mixing from the start?
No, I was tracking the beats and probably just doing rough mixes at that point. I don't even know if there were, you know, real final mixes going at the time. There was so much material from these guys through that period of time, you know, and we're going back a minute, so it's hard to remember it all. But the amount of time that I spent with him in the early days is, when you think back about it, it's kind of amazing. And I've had a number, you know, I've had a number of experiences of just sheer luck of people that I've either admired as artists or that were nobody when they started. And, you know, I think that's just how it works sometimes, is that it's, you get to work with some people who take you along the ride, they get successful, and you've been there the entire time. And sometimes that's just how it goes. So I was very fortunate in that respect that I was with him from the very beginning. And there were some other folks that I worked with that either already had huge careers and just happened to be in Chicago at the time. It's just one of those things.
Is it different starting with an artist that's like up and coming, and maybe like working with an artist that's already built a career?
Well, when you have an artist who comes in who's already well known, which has happened, you know, it happened early in my career several times. You know, you're apprehensive, you're nervous. You know, especially if it's someone that you've looked up to your entire life. I, you know, if you'd like me to share another story, I have a great one that I can speak to. Yeah. Back in, you know, in those early days, I think this is in 95 or 96, I got a phone call from a guy that I spent my entire, you know, teenage years listening to. And of course, we're going back sometimes. So some of the younger listeners might not even know who this is, but the very first concert I ever saw, Stadium Arena concert I ever saw, was this band called Styx. You guys probably are familiar, being from the Midwest.
The
younger listeners may not. But even before then, my junior high school, when the band first came out, their first hit, they had a contest. This was before they were even on a major label. They had a contest that was only in the Midwest that involved, being a Chicago band, Wrigley gum wrappers, Wrigley being the, you know, famous Chicago family that the Cubs are named after, obviously, or the stadium anyway. We won this contest in my junior high school for collecting gum wrappers. And the day of the concert, which was in Cleveland, their Chicago band, they canceled.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then fast forward, it was the first arena concert I ever saw was Paradise Theater, which was at the time, they were one of the biggest bands in the country. And, fast forward another 10 years, I'm in my studio, the phone rings, and it's this character named Dennis DeYoung on the phone who wants to book a session. Of course, I knew who it was immediately. And
no
they came
way.
Down and recorded an entire album in my studio, and I was just, you know, flabbergasted the entire time. And I can tell you that at this point, I probably talk to him 3 times a week. So, and I'll share that there isn't a week that goes by that I don't remind him that he canceled that show.
So currently, all these years, you're still talking to him
three times a week? I'm working on an album with him right now. I'm probably not supposed to divulge that there's one coming out, but there is. on Frontier Record, which is the label that kind of houses all of the bands from that generation. You name a band from the 70s, 80s, you know, especially in the rock genre, and most of those bands are coming out on Frontiers Records, which is an Italian label.
Okay. That's wild. That's not revenge, because it was a very small inconvenience for you, but man, that's just something great to hold on to forever.
Yes. And he's hilarious, and he's wildly bright, and he's a good sport, and I'm still a fan.
Nice. So was that your initial goal? Were you kind of more into the rock, kind of the Sticks and that type of band? Is that what you saw yourself working on?
Yeah, that was definitely what was popular at the time I was, you know, a teenager. And of course, I grew up, you know, being graduating high school at about the time that MTV was becoming absolutely huge. So all of the 80s MTV bands were, that was pop music back then. So that was the era that I grew up in. That was, you know, what I was interested in at the time, having no idea about hip hop, you know, again, yeah, from where I came from. But yeah, it's just funny how things tend to work out, I suppose. You can call it luck, or you can call it divine intervention, or you can call it, well, this is what I worked for my entire life and I made it happen. I'm not sure which one it is, or if it's a combination of all three.
Oh yeah, definitely a combination. I am curious. I'm not very educated in the technical side of things. That's Dylan, who I don't think I introduced you to. Very sorry about that. The other co-host, Dylan.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's Dylan? Now I'm going to ask the question. What's the background here?
I don't know. I do some production stuff. I use Ableton Live and make some beats, and then also do some live sound stuff every once in a while.
Okay, he's being a little modest. You did graduate college, correct?
Yeah, for audio engineering and sound design for visual media, but yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah.
And so your primary interest is in more urban and hip hop kind of stuff, being an ableton or dancer.
Yep. I kind of have learned to open my mind to everything. But yeah, I guess electronic hip hop, that kind of thing is what I like the best. But I have done some sessions with like rock bands and metal bands and singer songwriters and stuff like that as well.
Right on.
And how universal is mixing? Because that's your specialty. Is that something you can just kind of flow in between genres? And, you know, music is music. It's all the same.
I don't know if it's all the same, but because I had such a diverse clientele when I opened my studio in Chicago, I was exposed to pretty much every genre of music except for hard rock. That was something that never really took place in my room in Chicago. So it's also the one genre of music I don't have any credits in whatsoever. So metal, really hard rock and grunge, that kind of, well, although we did have the Smashing Pumpkins, but I didn't work on the stuff. But short of that, I was just exposed to every genre of music, and I have an appreciation for all of it, and I've had the opportunity to work on all of it. So for me, I can fairly well flow between these different genres. You know, the approach is a little different from one to the other, and of course the personalities are wildly different from one to the other, but that goes without saying. So I feel like I've been fairly lucky in being able to work in so many areas of music that I don't necessarily pigeon myself in one or another.
Do you find do the artists give you a lot of a lot of input into the mixes, or do they kind of give you the track and they're like, hey, I trust you with it, mix it how you think it sounds good, and I'll be happy with that?
If you can find me an artist that doesn't have to, I want to work with that guy for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No, they all have opinions. I have many clients that I've been working with for literally decades that now trust what I have to say and trust what I do. And there's not a whole lot of, you know, conversation back and forth or tons of tweaks, only because I know them and know their music so well that I know what they're going after. But everyone always has, you know, an opinion. There's never a time, doesn't matter if it's a new client, an old client, somebody I've been working with for 20 years, they always have a say so, and they always have something to say. Fortunately, like I said, there's enough of these clients that I've been working with for long enough that once I send a mix, if there's a handful of tweaks after I send it, you know, there's plenty of those.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, we've talked to C-Doc before on here, Chuck D's producer. They do a lot of stuff together. Mm-hmm. And he says that Chuck likes his rhymes to fall just a little bit off beat. He thinks it gives it a little bit more swagger, and that, you know, threw C-Doc for a loop initially because it's, you know, technically wrong. Have you ever had a request like that where somebody wants something that you think is technically wrong, but they like it for the style?
Well, I guess it depends on whether or not you're saying that's what comes out of Chuck as he's recording it, or after the fact they want to move it around and give it a different feel.
I think it was afterwards. He likes the rhymes to ultimately end up offbeat.
So they're moving it after the fact is what you're saying.
Yes.
I think I don't have any specific thing in mind where I've been asked to wildly change or alter how a performance has been delivered, you know, especially in a, you know, a hip hop performance. I think a lot of those guys have a feel and they deliver that feel a certain way. There's certainly, you know, instances where something is rushed or, you know, doesn't quite feel right and you move it around a little bit, but I don't know that I can come up with something where you categorically move it to a place that doesn't feel natural. But
yeah, that makes sense.
If I come up with something while we're talking here, I'll share it. But nothing comes to mind in that sense. I mean, if you think about Lupe, he definitely has a swagger and definitely has a feel that's different than, well, you know, all hip hop guys do generally, or the really successful ones. They're instantly identifiable based on what their flow is. So, and that's part of, you know, I assume what makes them appealing to people.
Right. Do you ever listen to the kind of lo-fi genre? Earl Sweatshirt had an album last year called Some Rap Songs, and a lot of people had problems with the mix, or people were kind of confused if it was intentionally low quality. Do you think that is an artistic choice to mix something just kind of low quality for the aesthetic of it?
Well, asking a guy who shoots for, you know, sonic excellence all the time, it would be hard for me to understand why anyone would want it to be low quality, frankly. I'm not familiar with that particular thing. As a guy who spends 12 hours a day listening to music, I don't often spend my free time listening to music, oddly enough. But I'm always shooting for, you know, a higher standard, not a lower standard. I can't find a particular reason to purposely make something sound terrible. I get a lo-fi vibe or some intentional harmonic distortion, but to purposely make it sound like crap doesn't make sense to me.
That's about the answer we were expecting, and that's kind of a hotly debated stance for that album. People just aren't quite sure what happened there, but. Just
well, maybe I should check it out and see what we're talking about. But
yeah, I get the overall idea of like making it kind of sound dirty. It's kind of like that punk style, you know, they just like.
Well, here's a question.
Yeah.
So is it done intentionally, or is it done because it's frankly, is it done as an excuse because it's just a lot cheaper to do it without hiring professionals? And then you can say, this is done in a fashion because I want it done this way, as opposed to going through the time, expense, and effort of doing it correctly. So in other words, yeah, if given an unlimited budget, would they still do it that way?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like they don't have the resources or the time, or they don't want to put in the resources or the time to
right. make it sound subsequently, good. And subsequently it becomes cool to have it that lo-fi way.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a divisive one. I think one thing, we've had other people think other things, but you know, in the end it's out there.
Right. And of course, you know, we're in the age of everybody's got a laptop. Everybody's got Logic on their laptop or Ableton. And so we're in a period of time, obviously, where professionals are not as valued, I should say, with startups and younger guys, just because of the cost and the expense of doing it correctly, as opposed to when I first started. When I think about what artists at that period of time were willing to spend to do to get it something recorded, that number compared to now is phenomenal and astronomical, and nobody thought about it twice. It's just the way it was. If you wanted to be an artist, you had no choice. You went, yeah, went into a recording studio, you gathered the money, you realized that if I want any chance at this, there's only one way to do it, and that was the way. So we're in the age of technology and modernization in so many areas that it's just scary.
And a lot of it's really good too, I think, like Isotope stuff. Sometimes
course, yeah, well, yeah, the tools are amazing, whether or not you have the skills and the wherewithal and the taste to use them, you know, in a way that is advantageous is a different story, but the tools that are available to all of us are exactly the same, frankly. And then it just comes down to skill level, time, and effort.
Yeah. So what is the Craig Bauer one thing when you're mixing your songs to all the 20-something-year-old guys out there that have a laptop with Ableton on it? What are they missing for when they're going through and mixing things?
Well, there's the obviously the technical stuff of the quality of the gear and specifically the converters and the monitoring system that you're listening through. So if you don't have good microphones, you don't have a good recording chain, you don't have a good A to D and D to A converter and subsequently good speakers to monitor it all through, you're at a massive disadvantage already. So that's on the technical side. The thing that you can't necessarily account for is 30 years of experience and what that means, you know, in the entire recording process from beginning to end. And there's no substitute for time spent and experience and taste. And that just has to be developed over time. There's just no two ways about it. You can't take a guy who's never been put in front of a mixing console or in front of Ableton or Logic and say, here, mix this. And even if they have a good idea of what they want it to sound like, if you've never done it before, you're not going to get great results. And the only thing that changes that is time, in my humble opinion.
No, that makes sense. No shortcuts. Just keep mixing after mixing. Keep doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously, you know, some people have an inclination for these things and some people don't. But whether you do or you don't, There's no shortcut for effort and time.
Sure. Do you have very many proteges, as it were? Do you have very many people that you're continually teaching mixing? Or are you just running the studio yourself for the most part?
Well, at this point, I've gotten so specific in how I like to do things that I don't have an assistant. I actually prefer at this point to prep my own mixes. It's just, and it's part of my process and what I do in mix prep that involves a lot of taste. I could train anyone to open a Pro Tools session and arrange tracks in a certain way, but there's things that I do in the prep that are almost production based and certainly taste based that I can't train somebody else's ears to do exactly what I would do in those instances. So for those reasons, I actually prefer to prep mix sessions myself, because the amount of time just to open a session and arrange tracks in a certain order and assign a few basic plugins isn't the bulk of the time spent in prepping a session. So for me, it's just better time spent not having to go back and redo if I just do it myself.
Sure.
On the other hand, after I moved from Chicago to LA, I had a staff of 5 and 6 people in my studio in Chicago. And every one of those guys are all working still in Chicago. They are all making a living. They're all doing decently. And so I like to feel good about the fact that I've left some imprint on people that have been able to make a decent go at it.
Yeah. And we thank you for that as people from the Midwest. Quit going to LA, everyone.
Yeah. Well, LA is tricky. You know, there's no shortage of people here doing it. So.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, a big thing in audio is your ears. How do you keep your ears like up to tune and just like in good health? Like what are
you mean
ear fatigue and stuff after a while you're listening to stuff and maybe you get a cold and your hearing goes weird and like how do you
I think the biggest factor is monitoring level. We didn't take that very seriously as guys in our teens and early 20s, and the biggest fear is obviously hearing loss and getting tinnitus. Fortunately, I do get my ears checked frequently. I don't have any tinnitus at this point. It's something I worry about, having done this nearly 30 years. And there are times where you have no choice but to crank the speakers because you got to see how it's hitting you.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to try to, get as much out of the time you spend listening loud. So you don't have to spend an enormous time doing it, but it's important every once in a while to crank it and make sure the kick drum's hitting you the way it needs to be hitting you. And sometimes you just need to feel it to know that it's going to make an impact on the client. But overall, I feel that listening at a moderate to lower moderate level is more revealing than listening to it really loud. The differences in balance and differences in EQ are more perceptible. Are more easily perceived at that volume than at cranking it all the time. I can tell you that, in the 90s, was I spending way too much time cranking it? Hell yeah, I was.
And from a more vague standpoint, after like 10 hours of mixing, do you ever walk away and come back the next day or anything and then just kind of wonder what you were thinking the previous day? Like, do you have any sort of blindness when it comes to hearing the music too much that you don't see, you kind of miss your goal?
I think that, missing the goal, I suppose that happens. I never like to send a mix off to, if you work on a mix and you technically finish it in a day, I never send that mix to the client that same night, because what you come back and hear with fresh ears is always the few things that might make the biggest impact, minor EQ moves or little minor balance things that you get so used to hearing it after 12 hours, you don't, when it hits you new the next morning or fresh the next morning, certain things become really obvious. So I don't make a habit of sending off mixes after, working on them for 12 hours, because inevitably the client's going to hear it fresh and they're going to hear the things that you hear the next morning. So I make a habit of making sure that I wait till the next day. I don't know if that answered your question, but
no, definitely. Are there any usual suspects when it comes to just things you miss after a long day when you come back? Is it the same EQ movements or any particular thing that keeps popping up?
I think the thing that changes most from the night before is probably just vocal level. For me, It seems to be the one thing, small little vocal rides, where you get so used to hearing something for 12 hours that you come in the next morning and something's just sticking out in a way that you go, maybe that vocal could be a half dB, you know, more in the track, or maybe it could be a dB louder. And these things become really apparent the next day. From an EQ standpoint, I don't often make huge changes from, you know, having after spending a day on it and coming back the next morning. I'd like to think at this point that, you know, zeroing in on the sonics of it generally isn't the issue, you know, over the course of the mix.
Yeah, that makes sense.
For me, it's usually like listening to headphones and listening to it on my phone speaker and then listening in the car and like just the going between those, it doesn't sound the same. How do you go about getting it sounding good on all different types of speakers, especially now with phone, like all different types of stuff?
How about the fact that we're having that conversation about now we have to listen to mixes through our iPhone speaker?
Yeah.
Wow, the world's changed. And it's something that we do. I have to also tell you that I don't send a mix out without listening to them in my earbuds for that same reason, because you got to know that that's what the, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that's where the client's hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am in this amazing room with that's absolutely incredible sounding with, you know, ATC speakers. I've never been in a better sounding listening environment, and I will never send out a mix without checking it thoroughly on earbuds. And I absolutely make changes to, you know, minor changes to EQ and levels, you know, in certain rides based on the earbuds. That's what the audience is generally listening to. So if you're not doing that, you're probably making a big mistake.
Yeah. Do you always go with what sounds best on headphones, or is it a sacrifice to make one sound better than the other?
To me, it's a sacrifice to make one sound better than the other, but nobody's listening to what I'm hearing in this room. Absolutely nobody. So as much as I prefer to hear it in here, who the hell else is hearing it like this? Nobody. So the end result is, frankly, what does it sound like in earbuds? What does it sound like on your phone? I'm not going to make EQ decisions based on, you know, listening through an iPhone speaker because there's no bottom end in it. However, it is absolutely imperative that I listen to it in earbuds because I know that all of my clients are hearing it that way. So if something's wildly sticking out, you got to go with the numbers and how the audience is going to hear it.
That's and how frustrating is that to be in, I'm sure, a multi-million-dollar studio knowing that people out there are going to be listening on $5 headphones? Does that bother you, or is it just...
You know, at this point, I think I'm over it. If you'd asked me that question 5 years ago, I probably would have had a different answer. But it's the reality that we live in, so either you fight it and make poor choices based on the fact that you don't want to adapt, or you deal with it. And I think I've come to accept it and deal with it.
Do you account for compression that happens in streaming and like uploading to YouTube and stuff like that? Or is that...
I let the mastering guy worry about that.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Fortunately, the one thing that's mixers that I'm sure you've probably heard before is that we can't send a mix back to a client that's softer than the rough. For the obvious reason is if they're used to hearing whatever's louder and brighter tends to sound better to the client. I'm not saying it is better, but one thing I don't like to do, and I'm sure mastering engineers are the same way, is they're not going to send back a master that's quieter than the mix. And for the same reason, I'm not going to send back a mix that's quieter than the rough. Every once in a while I get a rough that is so obnoxiously loud that I have to explain to the client that if I mix this as loud as this rough is, you've got nowhere to go, certainly in mastering, and it's already way too loud. And that absolutely happens. And so every once in a while, there has to be this conversation of, hey, you're way over compressing, you're way over limiting this rough, you're shooting yourself in the foot in doing so. The streaming services can't play it this loud. They're not going to play it this loud. So what are we going for here? And you have to carefully have these conversations with clients every once in a while, and it does happen. And look, there isn't a mixing engineer or mastering engineer on the planet that has 100% success rate. We learn from our mistakes, and every once in a while, you can't get a mix past a client that they're just not going to hear it the way you hear it. It's obviously not the bulk of what happens in successful people's careers, but any guy that's tells you that they have 100% success rate is obviously full of shit. And every once in a while, you can't make a client happy. And if it means I can't make a client happy because I can't get a mix as loud as their rough, and the rough is distorted and it sounds like absolute shit, and it's like, I don't want to mix it this way. I can't mix it this loud. You've got nowhere to go. And they don't want to hear that. What are you going to do? Doesn't happen often, but you know, it once or twice a year it happens.
Is that a sign of an experienced artist, or just a failure to comprehend kind of your aspect of things? Or do you see that in big name artists too, problems like that?
I don't see it in big name artists because they're generally understand. The roughs are still loud, way louder than they used to be. And it's a failure with new artists. It's a failure of understanding their own gear. It's a failure of understanding how streaming services work. And sometimes you have to educate your clients, and sometimes your clients educate you. That's just, you know, fact of it. I had a recently an unusual experience on a jazz record where there were no roughs. They didn't bother to make roughs. And this is a client that I've had for, you know, several times over the past couple decades and have Grammy nominations with, a phenomenal keyboard pianist. And I just mixed a record that his trio played on, and I don't think he sort of adapted with the times of, well, now mixes are way louder than they used to be. And I remember sending, this is only a couple months ago, I remember sending the first mix back to him. He goes, holy crap, is this mix loud? He's like, does it need to be this loud? And I'm thinking, this mix is nowhere near as loud as most of them that go out. And of course, it's a jazz record. And they, you know, I didn't sort of assume, or because there hasn't been a single experience in the past number of years where a client has said to me, wow, I didn't expect the mix to be that loud. And I was actually taken aback, and he's like, does it need to be this loud? I'm going, well, it's actually by today's standards, not screaming loud. And if you were to send this to any other name brand mixer, you would get back exactly the same thing. And he wasn't bent out of shape about it, but there's an instance where for a jazz record, wasn't expecting that. And again, this is wasn't a record that was screaming loud, but just wasn't used to getting mixes back that had some volume to them. And ultimately he loved it and it sounded great, but it was a learning experience and the other way around that time.
For sure. Just keeping up with the times. Do you have any
phenomenally talented pianist, like shockingly good, so you never know.
Different areas of expertise.
Correct.
Do you have any prognostication for the future of mixing? Where do you see things like that going? Do you think it's just going to keep getting louder, or where does it go from here?
Well, I think the streaming services have sort of hit the limit, so to speak. I don't imagine they're going to get louder than this. Let's hope not. You know, one can make the argument that louder mixes are not necessarily better mixes. I think if you talk to any really experienced mixing and mastering guy, they're going to tell you the same thing, that there becomes a point where if you're hitting LUFS of, you know, -6 and -7 throughout the course of a tune, that listening experience becomes fatiguing over time, especially on the, you know, certain types of records. It's one thing if it's a rock record where everything's, you know, there's tons of distortion and everything's compressed and everything's limited and it needs to be really aggressive. But if you're listening to a jazz record and it's LUFS of -7, that's not going to be a pleasant listening experience over a course of an album. In my opinion.
For sure.
Let's hope that it doesn't keep escalating from here.
You heard him, folks. Stop it. It's the perfect loudness. I am curious. We've talked kind of behind the scenes stuff. with mixing. What's it like being in the studio? Do you still get nerves ever working with big name artists?
Yeah, if you don't, I think there's a problem. For me, having that sense of I need to please this guy or I need to make this guy happen, and subsequently being nervous about it and having that adrenaline is a driving factor in making sure, if you're too comfortable in what you're doing, I don't know, I worry that if I was so comfortable that I never was, you know, worried about how the end result was going to come out, I'm not sure the end result would come out as good as it does. That's how I work. I'm not sure. You know, I think there's a lot of, without naming any names whatsoever, there's, you can go on Instagram and you look up some really well-known mixers and you see their, you know, their Instagram photo, and you can just feel the alpha bro-ness and the I'm the shit vibe. And it's, you know, I always, when I see that, I always wonder, it's like, well, I wonder if that's really how they feel or if it's an image that's portrayed. And, you know, if you go to my website, and yes, I have to portray, we all have to portray our successes, and we're all putting on our best face and we're all showing off our accomplishments. And, you know, when I look at the picture that the landing page of my website, and here's a wall of plaques, and I've got my head down as if to say I'm grateful, as opposed to I'm the shit. And maybe that works for me with certain clients, and maybe others appreciate, you know, I'm the fucking shit. That's a guessing game, I suppose.
I'm still looking at a wall of Grammy awards, so I think there's still some alphaness going on here, man.
Yeah, but, you know, and here I'm, you know, we're all talking about ourselves, and I'm not sure it's my natural state of affairs to gloat. It's not a great look. I like to think that I'm somewhat humble about it, and I'm certainly grateful for the success that I've had. I don't particularly gravitate to the I'm the shit attitude all the time.
Yeah, I watched the Hinge studio sessions with Ed Sheeran before this, and there's a few glimpses of you in there. How about being in front of the camera or on the mic? Is that more intimidating for you?
Yeah, it's not mine. If you'd asked me what I wanted to be when I was a senior in high school, or even a freshman in, you know, high school, I probably told you I wanted to be a rock star. As it turned out, I'm not cut out for that, because never mind the skill set or writing songs, but being in front of an audience isn't my natural state of affairs. There's actually a really funny story behind that Ed Sheeran thing, by the way. And I can say that when I look at those numbers of the number of views, and I can, here's where I can gloat, and I go, I'm in 100 million views on YouTube between four videos. There's not a lot of artists anywhere that can say that. And yet, I didn't make a dime from YouTube for being in those. Well, I mean, I got paid for the session, but, you know, that was right. Day's work, as opposed to, if you think about what 100 million views on YouTube means to Ed, I'll bet he did okay with that. I did not. But I get to say it. I get to say that I'm in 100 million views with Ed Sheeran. And it's awesome. I love that. Here's the funny thing about that video, by the way. The call that I got to do that session was from the video company. It was a video company that called me and said, hey, we have this new artist, and we want to do a video shoot. He was a fan of Kanye, and so he was wondering if we could do this video shoot in your studio. And I'm thinking it's a guy with a camcorder, because that's all the information they gave me. Wow. Literally. So the day of the session, I'm at the studio early thinking, and I think I had an assistant and probably an intern there at the time. And when they pulled up in two 18-foot box trucks, and it took them 3 hours to unload them and set the thing up. And I'm like, okay, who's this? Like, what is this? this is
you still don't know who's in the truck?
What's that?
You still don't know who's in the truck at this
point? Oh, he wasn't even in the truck. I just, they pulled up with two 18-foot box truck of gear. Oh. I mean, if you've seen the videos, you see, I mean, they've got the trolley and the train track thing, and there's three cameras and there's lights everywhere. And I'm like, all right, who is this? Like, what? Yeah, they had the video company call to book the thing, not the record label. Mind you, that, yeah, so, you know, an hour into it, you know, and then finally after they're set up and the, you know, there's an, you know, the doorbell rings for the studio, the intercom, and in walks this redheaded kid with literally a plastic guitar. Literally, that thing is plastic. You can see it in the video. And he's got the two stickers of the Bears on the two different guitars that he's has. And I'm like, okay, who are you? And it was literally the very first thing he had ever done in the States. And he's like, oh, and he introduced himself. And I'm like, okay. And I think I literally said to him, all right, what's the deal here? Cause some guy from the UK who's never been in the United States doesn't show up with two 18-foot box trucks. My record's been out in, you know, in Europe for a year already. I've sold 2 million copies. And I'm like, oh, okay. But, you know, that was, you know, shocking and hilarious. And I was dumbfounded. And here's these two 18-foot box trucks. The shoot went on all day. And, you know, excuse the gloating, but he was a huge Kanye fan. And he specifically picked me to do that because he was such a huge fan of Kanye.
Yeah. Do you ever get tired of that association? We try not to ask too many Kanye questions because I feel like you just got to get that a ton. Are you tired of it ever?
I don't want to be tired of it. It's not the worst thing to have a claim to fame to. So no, I'm not tired of it. I'd certainly, you know, what's interesting is that these guys that I spent years with, you think about, they begged me to cut them a break. And, you know, now getting a hold of his managers, I can't reach Kanye directly anymore. That's not a possibility. And you go from, well, wait a minute, 25 years ago, he was begging me to cut him a break. And now I can't get him on the phone. And it's like, you know, I wish that weren't the case, but it is the case. And his managers I'm still in touch with and still friends with. And the other guys from, you know, from the Go-Getters, I'm still in touch with, and you know, we're friends on Instagram. We communicate every once in a while. And Lupe, every once in a while, I'll post something about, you know, the anniversary of a you know, Lupe's record. And I just did that because the anniversary of Food and Liquor was September 19th, and I posted a whole thing about it on Instagram, and Lupe liked it. And I'm like, you know, that makes you feel good. I'm glad he's still following along.
Nice. Yeah, with artists.
One other thing. So I hadn't seen Kanye in a few years. When I first moved to LA, I was in touch with John Monopoly, who's his current manager and one of the guys that, you know, originally brought him to me back in the early 90s. He was living in LA, and I hit him up when I first moved here, and he invited me to a release party for Teyana Taylor. And I hadn't seen Kanye in a few years. And I remember I'm standing in this huge, you know, it was in a big cinema or a big movie sort of set sort of situation, a big empty warehouse that had been done up to the nines. And we'd gotten there earlier, and there were a bunch of people there that I knew. And he didn't walk in until probably an hour into it. And he walked in with Kim, and I was standing, I had to be 50 feet away. And he had been there for about 5 minutes, and he looked up and he saw me, and his face literally lit up. And he made a beeline to me and bear hugged me and picked me up off the ground. And I'm like, damn. But I haven't, you know, I haven't actually seen him since that moment. That was, I don't know, 3-4 years ago.
Yeah. I was wondering, was there any sort of, did you ever get a reasoning for him not using you for mixing after, what was it, Graduation?
No. I actually hit up, you know, he's got a new album coming out in days.
Today, I think. Isn't Jesus is King it, supposed
is
to
it
drop?
Today? Yeah, it may be today. I didn't learn about it until I think maybe 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. You know, am I going to, I'll be straight with you. It bums me out that I haven't been considered for that. And I actually hit up John via text about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. It was already obviously way too late. But I didn't know about it. And I hit him up and he was like, sorry about that. These guys get into a flow and I don't actually know who worked on the record yet. I suppose, you know, that can be revealed any minute if it came out. But I'd love to, you know, get back to that point with Kanye. I actually got along with him completely and perfectly fine. I mean, he is Kanye, and there's been moments here and there where, you know, Kanye is Kanye, but as a whole, you know, we've always gotten along great. I appreciate his skill set, and I understand that there are people who don't care for him or his behavior or his past behavior, and I can't go there because I'm just grateful for the fact that here's a guy that started in my studio, and you know, I have several Grammy nominations because of it. So if people say to me, well, isn't he an asshole? If you're looking to me to answer that question with a positive, yeah, he's an asshole, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Although I think he does owe you some cash. You should send an invoice.
Well, that and Ed. I'd rather get that check from Ed right now.
50-50, I think, would be fair.
That's how I feel about it.
Without... no need to name names, but have you ever worked with someone who either one of you have decided, like, man, never going to do that again?
Yeah, absolutely. And there isn't someone in this business that hasn't had that. And anyone who tells you otherwise is utterly full of shit. There's no way to get along with everybody. And there's no way to make every single client happy. If you can make more happy than you make unhappy, you'll have a career. So I'd like to think I've made more people happy than unhappy. But without naming names, you know, I don't even know who I can name that I've had such a horrible experience with. But you know, there's people who don't, you know, you don't vibe with, or they don't appreciate what you do, or personalities are just way too different. Shit happens.
Yeah. Is there any certain behavior that's just the end of it for you, that completely turns you off with working with someone?
You know, how do I answer this carefully? There's people who take and take and take and take and demand and demand and demand and demand and don't. We, as artists, we expect that to a certain degree, but if they do it constantly without showing any appreciation whatsoever, that gets old. And it happens. I don't mind working my ass off for people who are really demanding. Especially when they show some appreciation for the effort and the time and going above and beyond. And I'd like to think that I always go above and beyond. It's part of the nature of this game. And if you want to be successful, especially in this period of time where everyone with a computer is a mixer, I don't think you have a choice but to go above and beyond if you want to stay working.
Totally. That makes sense. We just have a few more minutes. Speaking of being grateful, very grateful to have you on. We won't take up too much more of your time here, but I got to know, how did you get involved with the Mother Lover sketch exactly?
that's a good question. That was hilarious, by the way. Here's the backside to this story as well. So I was really good friends with his manager at the time, a guy named Ken Commissar. I met Ken probably a handful of, I'm trying to, you know, remember exact time frames here, but I had met him, I think it was in the, you don't happen to know when Idol started on TV, do you? Was it the late 90s or early 2000s? I mean, I'm trying to remember when it was.
Probably early 2000s, it's got to be.
So, if you recall, and probably don't, I think it was after the first or second year Idol was on the air, Oprah, as in Oprah Winfrey, decided she was going to do her version of American Idol. And it was this thing. It was a series on Oprah called Oprah's Pop Stars.
Okay.
And every week, I think this went on for a few months, she did her version of American Idol. And that entire series was shot and recorded out of my studio in Chicago. Obviously, Oprah was in, you know, that was filmed in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
So, and it was done through Epic Records. And the guy at the time that was managing the project for Epic was an A&R guy, and his name was Ken Commissar. So I was with him day in and day out for months, because his project went on forever, and we became very good friends. In fact, I just did a mix for one of his clients 2 weeks ago. But so we became very good friends, and after that period of time, he went on to managing Justin. So when this opportunity came up, the first person he called was me. The funny thing about it was, in a similar fashion, I was not told what this thing was. The only information I got was that Justin was going to be on SNL, and that he was doing a musical piece that was for the show, and was I interested in mixing it? And of course I said yes. I wasn't even told it was the follow-up to Dick in a Box. When this track shows up, and of course it's not bleeped, you know, the original session, there's no bleeps for any of the cussing that's going on. And I play this down, and I'm looking at my, and we're like, what in the fuck is this? Like, are you kidding? I had no idea. And it wasn't until after I picked the phone and like, okay, what the hell is this? That it was explained to me that it was actually the follow-up to Dick in a Box. So the funny thing about that also is that the bleeped version is way funnier than the one without it bleeped.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Because you have to, you know, you have to use your imagination. So that's how that went down.
So just to reiterate, when you're working with Ed Sheeran, the video people call you, and when you're working for SNL, Justin Timberlake managers call you.
Correct.
All right. Seems like that could be a little bit better. I don't know.
Yes. Yes. That was, you know, again, and then I worked with Justin another couple of times after that here in LA. So yeah. And here's another story. There's a wine bar not far from my house. And I think about a year ago, I haven't seen him in probably a few years since the last time I worked with him, probably the, you know, 2011, 12 it had been, so a handful of years. And I walk into this wine bar, and he is at the counter with his wife, sitting there, and he was, let's just say he was in a good mood and had no idea who I was. Absolutely not. So it's funny that you just randomly run into these people that you work with every once in a while.
Yeah, such major people. And to them, I mean, I don't know how many mixing artists Justin Timberlake's gone through, but it's got to be a ton, huh?
Yeah, it's got to be a ton. And I can tell you that when I was working with him, there was a project that I was working on with an artist that he was working with at the time. And Jessica was showing up at the session, and this is before I was married, and I flirted with her relentlessly.
Jessica Biel.
Relentlessly. She was just, yeah, she was. I liked her.
Yeah. I mean, how can you not?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And she looked none too pleased that night that I ran into him at the bar. She was not quite as happy as he was at the time.
I don't think any story could top that. So on that note, thank you so much for coming. Usually we ask if people have anything to plug, but I mean, if you're in LA, check out Hinge Studios. Is that the recommend? Maybe your masterclass?
Sure. Better yet, book me. If you're an artist and wants a great record, there you go. There's the plug.
Do it. All right. Thank you for being here so much. Thank you for listening, everyone at home. We'll be back next week from the land of 10,000 hot takes. It's been Peyton Kaiser, Dylan Schemenauer, and Craig Bauer. We'll be right back.